Today, the Bond Kingdom, is it under attack? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve Van Meter. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I appreciate your time. And it's been an interesting few days, hasn't it, with all of the attacks being mounted on the Bond Kingdom?
Well, it's a persistent attack, I think, going back to August of last year. But boy, it's gotten pretty heavy all of a sudden. I keep wondering who is left to possibly sell. But sure enough, every night somebody's out there selling.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. And I'd argue that the Fed has been using the RBA as a bit of a patsy in terms of, yield control and what have you, because the Reserve Bank bought last Thursday, bought last Friday, bought Monday to keep the rate down, the three-year rate down here in Australia. Not totally successfully, I have to say.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Powell has said in the past when directly asked about yield curve control, he's like, it's really hard to do. And you kind of, you know, like, is it a mechanical thing? No, it's just, it's people don't understand. It's like, if the yield goes up during the day, they have to come in and buy. But how much do you buy? So they probably end up buying too many or not enough, and then they look foolish. Then the next day they try to adjust. They're constantly having to do it. And I think what we're seeing that with the RBA right now. And what I think Powell thinks it meant is, look, it's just easier if we just pick some arbitrary number, act like it really is meaningful, and we can stick to that every day.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we've said a couple of times, Steve. There's a lot of waffle going on here, right, from central banks. They're trying to convince the market and everybody else that they know what they're doing and everything's under control, et cetera, et cetera. Except that the fundamentals do seem to be pointing in a rather different direction. And, we've discussed inflation, deflation over the last few shows. And I'm fascinated by more and more people are just piling into the inflation bandwagon saying, see, massive inflation coming. And yet the fundamentals don't necessarily point that way.
No, they don't. In fact, when I look at what's going on in the global government bond markets, particularly the long end of the curve, something that I think you and I both have talked about and believe will happen is there will be a day in the equity markets, global equity markets, that they will just seem as if the selling will never stop. Little did I ever predict that this would happen in the bond markets, that you're just seeing machines and all kinds of asset allocation and institutional. I mean, literally every model and every strategy is saying, we have to sell and we have to sell now. And if we're not selling, we should go short. And you look at the fundamentals. And I think one of the things that I really like to look at is the ISM Purchasing Managers Index. And I know in Australia you have something similar. I don't know exactly if it has a fancy name like the ISM does. But one thing I find really interesting about it is it looks at what's input prices coming into manufacturing sector. It doesn't specifically look at the outflow, which is something I think you and I would look and say, hey, I bet you they're not getting the same price. And everyone sees that number going way up as a number of manufacturing firms around the world report higher and higher input prices, which makes perfect sense. Because when you dig at least into the US side of it, what's the two biggest drivers in that? Crude oil and a weak dollar. So you have both of those. And so everyone's looking at that going, okay, that means prices are headed higher. And one thing I like to slow people down and say, look, it just means where they're at right now. There's no view that it says they're going to go higher. It actually says they've gone up a lot. And if you look on a chart and you run the ISM prices paid against the US dollar and against crude oil, you'll find that when the prices paid index peaks, The dollar is bottoming or has bottomed and crude oil is about to peak and roll over. And then what happens in the months that follows is the number of firms reporting price increases decreases. And lo and behold, it also signals a peak in treasury yields, which I'm going to go on out on a limb and say that's going to cover the global bond market right now by around 2 months. So all the fundamental things that you can really look at from a timing perspective say this really ought to be it for the peak in global yields. But the selling doesn't seem to be stopping.
No, indeed. And it's interesting, going back to the bond market for a second, two observations. You mentioned machine trading, right? And I think people don't understand how much of this is just automatic, right? There's no trader sitting there saying, oh, I think I'll buy now. It's all driven by the machines. And the second is that, of course, you've also got this interesting question where you can create effectively a copy of a bond and take a position against it. And so there is actually an interesting question as to how many trades are going on vis-a-vis the underlying amount of bonds that are out there.
Yeah, that's a question there really is no answer to. The last study I saw, which was years and years and years old, the gal that went out and did the study was trying to figure out for every one real U.S. Treasury security, how many actually exist. And the answer was, we can't figure out how many actually exist, but based on what we can tell, there's over two times the number. For every one, there's two plus. Now, I'm not saying it's three, it's 2 point something are out there in the wild. And it kind of is interesting when you can make a copy of something and then just flood the market with it. What happens is you just get massive amounts of issuance at a time, as I've said before, that governments around the world are literally desperate to borrow money to try to get the economy out, their local economy out of the toilet. And yet, so they're flooding with new issuance at a time when speculators and machines are saying, well, programming says short. Borrow security, sell it into the market, and dealers are like, yeah, okay, you want to do that. Here's another copy, go sell it. And I think that's really what the issue is here. But for those who think yields can only go up forever, the scary part for them will be, if you're on the short side, is once all of this is mopped up, and at some point it will be. How or when, I don't know, but it will be. When the reverse happens and all these people have to go cover their shorts and get a bond, they're going to find out that everyone who's got a ton of them and doesn't want to sell.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because I've been arguing for some time that pretty much all of the financial markets, whether you look at the bonds market or the futures market or the gold market, wherever you look, the underlying and all of those derivatives and all of the bits hanging around is the bit that people don't get, right? So effectively, all the markets are to an extent manipulated and being messed around by all the derivatives that are there.
Yeah, and the interesting thing to tack onto that is you've seen largely, except for the RBA, central bankers just sitting on their hand going like, we don't know what to do. We'll make you feel good, but we're not sure why this is all happening. And that derivatives market I don't have any actual data on, but I would imagine if I could see it, it's probably exploding beyond what anybody's expectation.
Well, it's been growing, and of course, nobody quite knows, right? Because there's no real official reporting on so many of the different types of derivatives that are out there. And it's interesting when you talk to individual people in the market, they actually don't know. They don't know what proportion is. If I take silver, for example, some people think, well, it's something like 50 times underlying to all of the positions that people have, and gold maybe a bit less. But the point is, this is actually messing the markets, and there are people basically on the sell and the buy side trying to take positions, and it's the volatility that they're actually trading, right? So they're not interested in the fundamentals. They're not interested in, central bank strategies, et cetera. This is about just momentum plays and trading volatility.
Right, and a lot of people don't realize that. They buy calls on options on something, and the price goes up, and their options go down, and they don't understand. Well, they actually bought a position on the volatility of that underlying security, and so you can get rising prices with volatility falling. You can get rising prices with volatility rising too, which if you're long something, that's ideally what you want, is it to go up very, very quickly. And, if you look at the bond space, the worst thing that could happen for anyone who's short the bond market is for the Fed to come out. And I don't think they're going to do a yield curve control. I don't think that's what Powell would do. But if they did an Operation Twist or just increased their QE purchase or restructured, then said, we're going to buy more at the long end. I mean, they could alone trigger this huge, huge unwind. And the market, the derivative market would just explode as all these shorts had to go running.
Well, you mentioned Operation Twist, and I was going to mention that myself, because the idea is you basically buy one end of the market and you sell the other, and you try and sort of tweak the market, right? It's been done a few times in history, and there is speculation that we might see some of that, because the central bankers are going to get more and more desperate to try and control this whole yield curve, and, you know, yield curve control is something we'll probably hear more about. Whether it's really feasible and whether it really can make a difference, of course, is an interesting question. And it goes back to the fundamental question is, well, okay, so the Fed and other central banks have unlimited resources, but if they're throwing those unlimited resources into strategies that actually aren't going to achieve the outcome, just doing more of the same isn't necessarily going to actually achieve a different outcome.
Well, no, it won't. In fact, I want to come back to the Operation Twist thing because it's really interesting to talk about that subject. Because right now, at least in the United States, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, not the former Fed chair now, she said, hey, there's going to be a massive bill shortage, T-bill shortage in the U.S. banking system. Now, you would think as a person in charge of issuing debt in the country, that what she would do is reduce the issuance of notes and bonds on the longer end of the curve and increase the issuance of bills. Instead, she's actually canceling two bill options and reducing the size of them. Now, which really is baffling. If someone says, well, why is there a bill shortage? Well, as all this money that the government is sitting on, which is around $1.6 trillion, as that stimulus bill eventually gets passed and that money gets paid out into the economy, consumers saved 30% of that. At least the last stimulus reports now are saying they're going to save upwards of 40% of it. Well, that gets deposited in the banking system. Now, the banking system then has to pay interest on it. So they have to match that liability with an asset on the other end. Well, what is the thing? What do they do? Well, they go out and they buy treasury securities. So lo and behold, Americans who don't like government debt are actually inadvertently buying government debt through QE. Well, the banks love to buy bills and short-term notes, but there's not enough bills out there. So one way the Fed could solve the problem that for whatever reason, I think you and I could never come to a conclusion of why Yellen is doing what she's doing, is what the Fed can do is they're sitting on about $380 billion of T-bills on the Fed's balance sheet. So they could easily come out and say, look, we're going to do an Operation Twist. Well, we're going to swap the banks' T-bill for an equivalent, note or bond, not equivalent, but a note or bond. And, they could do, say, $100 billion of it. The Fed's balance sheet would be unchanged. It would give the banks the bills they need, and then they could drive that long end of the curve right back down. Now, if they did that, boy, I'll tell you what, I think the bond kingdom would have a very glorious time during that period.
Well, we're watching for that, and we'll listen for the fanfares as the kingdom conquers once again. One question I've got, though, Steve, and somebody asked me the other day of this, the U.S. is talking about the $1.9 trillion stimulus, right, of which some of it will go to real households and real businesses this time. What's your perspective in terms of, is that inflationary, do you think, or is that just not going to make a lot of difference?
That's a really interesting question because the broad view of it is inflationary. And I totally get why that is. And let's say the United States was a closed system. And U.S. taxpayers actually funded the U.S. government entirely, which they don't, but let's just pretend they did. In a closed system, what you would have is money being drained out of one side and filling up in a glass on the other side. So when that glass on this side gets emptied, it fills up over here, and then you would perceive, well, that is inflation. It makes perfect sense, except when you realize that Americans generally don't buy most of the government debt, and there's a third player, which we'll just say is foreign investors, central banks, and all that. So all you're seeing is just money moving around the table. Stimulus isn't the creation of money. The act of the TGA or the federal government borrowing this money was existing money. It didn't create new money. So if you're moving money around on the table, for every action on one side, so coming out of the TGA into the U.S. economy, there's going to be a negative impact somewhere else, which would then be on the foreign side where you see persistent dollar shortages because foreign governments and foreign investors tend to loan the U.S. government money on the belief that either they will directly get money back in some other form, right? So the U.S. government provides aid in some other way that we do things or buys things, or the U.S. consumer is going to spend that money back abroad. If it doesn't happen, then what you get is a persistent dollar shortage in the foreign economy, and you get a large number of deposits into the banking system in the U.S., which could and likely will drive the front end of the yield curve potentially negative. And for those who think that drives the long end up, keep in mind, the long end is historically, a 90% correlation with the front end, which tells you the long end could come crashing way down.
Yeah, indeed. And interesting, here in Australia, of course, there's also talk about inflation. And in fact, the latest CPI included a couple of one-offs. So, for example, they made childcare free earlier on, and then they actually started charging for childcare. So, of course, that put the costs up. And they also threw a whole lot of incentives to buy off-the-plan properties. And, of course, that meant that those actually were reflected in a very higher CPI. But all of those are, you know, passing, transitory, right? And so my expectation is there might be a very short-term blip of inflation, but this isn't structural inflation because wages is still flat in real terms. It's been flat since 2012. And in fact, the latest print suggests that it's going to continue. Indeed, the Reserve Bank itself says, look, you've got to understand, we're going to get no wages growth for the next 3 to 4 years, right? So the chances of seeing any inflation over that period is pretty low, if non-existent. And by the way, unemployment's still higher than it was before the the virus came. So the conditions for structural inflation just don't exist, as far as I can see.
Yeah, in fact, what you've described is a liquidity trap, which occurs when central banks do quantitative easing or, you know, large-scale asset purchases, whatever you want to call it. Mm. And what happens, the challenge here is you have the demand for money. And as I mentioned earlier, as all of these deposits hit the U.S. banking system, well, the Fed has to buy a reserve. And how does a reserve getting created is by a commercial bank taking deposited money and buying a treasury security so the Fed can do that flip with it. So what you see is this growth in the money supply, and it gets misinterpreted like all the time. And so QE causes a demand for money. Well, the actual money supply needs to grow several times, at least four times or more above and beyond the QE. So if you, so a case of the Fed, they're doing 120 billion a month. You need to see the money supply growing realistically at nearly 500 billion a month. Now, how is it possible to do that? Well, it either comes from the creation of new money through lending, which here in the US and I presume in Australia is not really happening as much as it needs to, or by borrowing from outside sources and bringing it in. So what happens is you get all these transitory effects in the CPI. And the way that comes out of is if the growth or the demand for money exceeds the growth of the money supply, then consumer prices have to fall. Something has to fall. So if you see prices rise over here, it's kind of like a whack-a-mole game. You see prices come over here, something's going down here. And you go, okay, well, that was transitory. It's going to switch. Well, then, gosh, it switched again. And all the CPI experts that are predicting higher inflation, like every month, it's the same thing. Well, gosh, this went up, but why did that go down? It's because we're in a liquidity trap. And none of the central banks are actually creating money. They're just distorting how the system is working. And it actually leads to deflation, which comes back to, again, you know, you can have, say, higher prices here, but you might have lower wages. Well, if you have lower wages, those higher prices get rejected. Same with interest rates. Everyone gets that wrong, too. Interest rates are going up, but they will get rejected because people, there's not enough money supply growth to support them in terms of people who want to borrow at those higher rates, and they get rejected. So, yeah, you pretty much describe exactly what a liquidity trap is. And I think that's the problem central bankers are faced because they deny the existence of it. You can actually read that some of the regional Fed banks have written about it. And the answer is, they pretty much don't. It's like a black hole. It doesn't exist. Well, they do. You can't look right at it. You got to look around it and go like, aha, there it is. And getting out of it, well, that's a real difficult problem because central bankers don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah, well, I sometimes use the analogy of the black hole, right, that we're actually circling around at the moment. But, you know, the chances of us being able to escape is getting more and more unlikely as the quantitative easing continues. So the escape velocity would be even more excessive to try and do it. And so the chances are we're going to go round and round and round and disappear into the black hole. And interestingly, the money supply here has shot up as well. So credit growth is really, really low at the moment. Okay, there's a little spike in sort of housing lending because they've thrown lots of incentives and really low rates at the housing sector. But overall business lending is still very low and overall credit growth is way down, but the supply of money has gone way, way up, right? Not surprising, as the effect you've just mentioned. Interestingly, of course, in the US, they've stopped reporting some of those money supply numbers.
Well, they only stopped reporting on a weekly basis. They're still reporting it on a monthly. There's something called Regulation D, and it probably has to do with some other banking requirements to change that. So, yeah, it is a good question that a lot of people because they look at the money supply and they say, look, that has to be inflationary, but they don't understand exactly why the money supply is growing. Part of it is there's the consumers are depositing money, but the other factor is, let's just pretend that government interest rates or the Fed funds or whatever interest rates are high, right? 6, 7, 8%. Well, people wouldn't be holding cash because if they're holding, right? We all have our emergency fund. Like, hey, things go really wrong. I got to have, some money. And then you have your excess savings, hopefully. Well, your excess savings, you kind of might need it, but you're not sure. So you put it out at a longer rate. Well, the problem with quantitative easing, it drives the interest rates so low that, when I go and trade a rate of cash to lock my money up, say, in a 5-year CD for the difference of 0.1%, I wouldn't. Why would I do that? And the consumer is smart enough to know that as well. So the reason we see the money supply growing is because consumers are looking out at options for their money and seeing it doesn't make any sense. But that's actually part of design, because quantitative easing is literally a Pac-Man of cash. It needs cash in the banking system for the banks to create reserves to swap. Well, how do you get people to put cash in the banking system and do nothing with it? Effectively drive, 12-month or 2-year yields, 3-year yields, all the way down to next to zero. And I guarantee you cash will pile up. But the belief is this money's coming out. Yeah, it's not coming out. Not the way people think. It's going to get stuck and trapped in the banking system for sure.
And, the point you made, and I'll just underscore it again, it has to be a logarithmic increase to have any impact, right? So they can't just do the same amount as last month. They've actually got to do more and more and more and more and more and more just to stand still.
Right, exactly. And so if the money supply isn't growing, then QE is actually creating even more of a deflationary effect. And before the Fed actually got rid of the or whomever was in charge of the weekly money supply data, the last 3 weeks in the US were dead zero. Yeah. So that actually means that, so we had no money supply growth. And then if we factor the negative impact of QE, it actually is a negative money supply growth. So it's even worse. It's literally like a game of musical chairs. It's the best way to describe it. There's only so much money in the system. There's only so, which is the chairs, and there's people circulating. And at some point, the music's going to stop and people are going to look around and somebody is going to lose. And that's how you get deflation, because there isn't enough money supply growth. The literally only way out of this black hole that we're spiraling around, there's several ways. One is the central bankers could stop doing QE and raise rates. They're not going to do that. That's not going to happen. The second way is you could drive rates low enough to get lending growth. Now, that's actually the best way to get out of it. But the problem is, the economies are and we're all hurt. A lot of unemployment. And then the third way, you have to have a massive amount of exponentially growing direct to consumer stimulus that will end up in the money supply. There's a limit to what governments can borrow and get away with. So that's not going to happen either.
No, absolutely. It's interesting, the UK in their budget, because, of course, the UK is struggling with the virus at the moment, but they actually signaled ahead tax increases quite clearly, right? And they basically said, we'll probably have to put the corporate rate of tax up for large corporates, and we will have to freeze the tax allowances for everybody else. Very interesting that they're talking about that now. Now, that's another example of a deflationary impact.
Yeah, and they have no choice, because I think a lot of people, particularly the United States, and I'm not familiar with who buys Bank of England debt specifically, or buys the UK debt, is there is a point where people get tired of you borrowing money. And they're like, look, you've got money over there. Why don't you go take some of that? And it's pretty easy, right? The global stock markets are up. Go tax the big corporations. Go tax the wealthy. Go take some of that money back and use it to fund your deficits. And that way, the lenders, whoever are out there, will feel better about it, knowing that you're not sucking them dry, constantly going back for more and more that they don't have. Because, again, we come back to dollars have to go out of the U.S. to other places to come back. Well, if consumers aren't buying out there and the government's not spending out there, that means there's fewer and fewer dollars out in the foreign economy. They're not going to borrow our money, our debt, putting pressure on, again, either Americans through QE to do it, which has a lot of negative impacts, particularly on the job market, or go tax the rich. They've got a bunch of money. Yeah, go do it. They have no choice.
Absolutely. And I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about some of those tax-related strategies, not immediately, but over the next 12 to 18 months. And just reflecting on the final issue, the stock market's, of course, been still going quite strong, a bit wobbly, but still going up because they still believe that the central bank doctrine is going to actually be good for stocks.
Well, absolutely. And there's going to be all this inflation and pent-up demand as soon as people get their stimulus checks, economy get their shots, economy reopens. And one of the things I've said, good, you want to see more deflation, open up the economy, because in a liquidity trap, again, you're coming back to this teeter-totter of right now, there's a few companies that are really benefiting because they've been able to adapt, or they were designed to adapt to situations like this. But when all these mom and pop businesses now have to reopen, that money is going to get spread back down across the whole system. And what's going to happen is everybody's going to lose. But the notion is that there's all this demand, right? That everyone's going back to work, and that there's going to be lines of customers out at every door just throwing money at it. And they're going to find out that due to the persistent shortage of money in the system, that if there is a burst, it will be nothing more. And then everything will get spread across unevenly, unfortunately. And a lot of businesses that thought they were going to make it, well, are going to find out they can't, because their competition's back, and that's going to pull money away from them. So, yeah, I don't see it playing out. But yeah, the stock market continues to be an anomaly that perhaps one day in our lives we will actually see go down. Don't know when that is, but someday I think it will.
Well, I consistently say it's very unpredictable. The volatility, I think, is the thing to watch, and there's a lot of momentum trading both in stocks and other areas. But the fundamentals that you touch on, Steve, I think are so important for people to understand, because a lot of the mainstream and a lot of the central banks don't want you to know about this stuff.
No, they don't. I mean, if you kind of look at their behavior right now, they don't know what to do. I mean, the long end of the curve wasn't supposed to go up. COVID wasn't supposed to go this long. And what we're seeing is, unfortunately, persistent now unemployment, which doesn't really make any sense, because data here is not, close to 10% of the people are, have gotten their shot. People are wearing masks. Businesses are getting their stuff on. And why are we seeing so much unemployment? Well, one of the interesting things is, and again, you come back to the negative impact of QE, it actually is a job destroyer. And the central bankers do not know that yet. They have not figured that out, but it literally destroys jobs because, again, you shrink the available amount of money, and now there's fewer chairs, and the music's going to stop, and someone's got to lose. So I know I saw JP Morgan today, or some one of the big banks, that they thought there's going to be 600,000 jobs plus a month. And I'm like, well, it might be for a month or two, but it's not going to be persistent, because as these businesses reopen, they're going to find out that they're going to hire everyone back and find out they don't have the business to support them. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. Eventually, the stock market will have its day, and I'm sure we'll get together and celebrate that.
Yeah, and just on the jobs, it's very interesting, of course, because the Reserve Bank here has been forecasting, very low unemployment, but never happened. They've been consistently wrong on it. They're now forecasting it will come down again. They'll be consistently wrong again for precisely the reason that you've actually just underscored. And again, I don't think many people understand this. We have structurally high unemployment. It is very unlikely that it's going to come back to where it was previously. And frankly, with everything else that's going on in terms of the demographic shifts and the automation and all those other broader things too, unemployment is going to be probably one of the biggest issues that will haunt us, not just for a few months or years, but actually intergenerationally.
Yeah, and that'll lead to what? More disinflation or deflation, more quantitative easing, and more government either direct to consumer stimulus or perhaps job creation, like we've seen governments do in the past, where they put people on the payroll and have them build bridges and roads and whatever we need.
Yeah. Well, that takes you into the old UBI and we'll pay you some money whatever you do. So, I mean, you start breaking more economic rules to try and actually solve the fundamental structural issue which they created in the first place.
Right. Yeah. They don't realize that the negative impacts of quantitative easing. I mean, they have no clue. And the more you look at it and the more you understand what it is and what it does, And the only, and the limited way out, which is primarily through lending growth, which I don't, you know, particularly since the baby boomers are moving every year more and more into retirement, you know, they're in spend down, you know, debt payoff mode, not debt expansion mode. And you look at the young millennials, well, you know, they're struggling in this, you know, they struggled to begin with when they came out of college into a job market with a lot of debt, and now they don't have a lot of jobs. So, you know, you need this borrowing, and you could have zero interest rates like we've seen in Japan and still not be able to get what you need. And I think that, I don't know, maybe someday I'll still be alive when central bankers realize that QE doesn't do anything that they thought it was, but who knows, maybe it'll go on until the day I die. I have no clue.
But meantime, the bond kingdom, still unassailable.
Well, we're still here, and we still stand strong because, you know, like you said, the fundamental data is, in the end, is never wrong.
Steve, I really appreciate your time today. If people want to find more about you, where do they go?
Yeah, they can go to my website at stephenvanmeter.com. Also, I'm sure you've linked my YouTube show. They can find that. Just put my name into the YouTube search, and 3 days a week I do a macro show. On Sunday, I do a chart show. So I'm on Twitter, on Facebook. I'm easy to find if you go looking.
Absolutely. And you've got quite an audience now, and more shows coming, huh?
More shows coming. You know how it is.
I do indeed. Steve, appreciate your time today. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure. Take care.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Martin.
Cheers.